content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be reached at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the December 4th, 2020 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows President Trump standing at the presidential podium. He's wearing one of those gaudy military outfits with white gloves and a hat that sometimes the strongman military dictators wear. And on either side of him are lawyers Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell. They're both dressed in circus clown outfits. The title is The Failed Coup. Have Trump and his clownish lawyers damaged democracy? That's our first main story. Trump's failed attempt to overturn the election. What happened? The transition to a Joe Biden administration officially began this week after President Trump failed in his efforts to overturn election results in six states with empty claims of massive fraud. Emily Murphy, the head of General Services Administration, bowed to weeks of pressure and signed the paperwork greenlighting the transition, a decision that came hours after Michigan certified Biden's win in the state. Trump, who groundlessly claimed widespread voter fraud in Detroit, had attempted to delay the certification and met with Michigan's top GOP lawmakers in an unsuccessful bid to sway them to overturn Biden's win and appoint Trump electors. Pressure mounted on Trump as more than 160 business leaders, 100 Republican national security experts, and at least three GOP senators urged him to concede, calling his resistance a threat to the economy and national security. But even when Trump tweeted that he'd approved the transition, he made clear he wasn't conceding. "We will prevail," he said. Still, a campaign advisor deemed his acceptance of the transfer as close to a concession as you will probably get. The reluctant surrender came after a series of humiliations for Trump's legal team, which had 36 challenges shot down by state and federal judges. After a bizarre, rambling court appearance by Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani, a federal judge blasted the bid to block Pennsylvania's vote certification as a Frankenstein's monster of strained legal arguments. At a rambling press conference, Giuliani and attorney Sidney Powell alleged a vote-rigging plot involving Venezuela and communist money as rivulets of dark hair dye flowed down a sweating Giuliani's cheek. When Powell later charged that Republican Georgia Governor Brian Kemp had been bought off in the alleged scheme, the campaign disavowed any connection to her. Such antics prompted Trump ally Chris Christie to call the legal team a national embarrassment. "The U.S. is beginning to look like we're a banana republic," said Republican Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. Biden announced key cabinet picks, and an aide said his team would soon begin meetings with administration officials. High on the priority list were getting the president's daily brief of intelligence and coordinating with the White House Coronavirus Task Force on mitigating the current surge and plans to distribute vaccines. A Biden transition aide said another goal was to gain complete understanding of the Trump administration's efforts to hollow out government agencies. What the editorial said. The Giuliani-Powell press conference was a new low in Trump's disgraceful gambit to overturn a lawful election, said NationalReview.com. Between Giuliani's wild-eyed conspiracy mongering and Powell's fantasies of communist-designed election machinery, reversing a Trump landslide, it was the most outlandish and irresponsible performance ever by a president's lawyers. The campaign's profoundly undemocratic strategy of trying to block vote certifications and rally legislatures to override voters' will was so reckless it would have ignited a major constitutional crisis if it hadn't fizzled. This time, Trump went beyond political norm breaking to a direct assault on democracy itself, said the Washington Post. Though the shocking effort to overturn a free and fair election failed, Trump persuaded more than half of Republicans that he rightfully won the election and that Biden stole it. These people will not just preemptively reject their next president, but also doubt the democracy in which they live. What the columnist said. What has happened to my fellow conservatives? Asked Matt Lewis in the DailyBeast.com. A willingness to line up behind the evidence-free ravings of Giuliani and Powell became a litmus test for sanity within the Republican Party. And from radio host Mark Levin to Fox's Lou Dobbs to Senator Lindsey Graham, many failed. The dividing line on the right is no longer between wingers and rhinos, but between reality and insanity. The clown coup may have failed, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com, but had Biden's margin been just a hair smaller, more Republicans would have backed it, and it just may well have prevailed. The fraud claim now gives Trump a way to preserve the Trumpian mythos that he's a winner who loses only when he's treated very unfairly. The weeks of chaos also served to remove all doubt that the American experiment would never have survived a second Trump term. The Pandora's box Trump opened won't easily be closed, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. Increasingly a minority party, Republicans have lost the popular vote in 7 of the past 8 presidential elections and have already shown their willingness to use any means necessary to exercise power, including Mitch McConnell's stonewalling of Obama Supreme Court nominee Merrick Garland. Trump's blatantly racist campaign to toss out votes in heavily black cities such as Detroit, Philadelphia, and Atlanta came to naught this time. But far too many Republicans have shown they believe that holding on to power is more important than preserving America's democracy. Our controversy of the week is schools. Should they be open amid the pandemic? Some things are true even though President Trump says them, said Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times. This summer, as COVID surged across the country, liberals reflexively opposed Trump's demand that states reopen the nation's schools for in-person learning. But in hindsight, Trump's supposedly reckless approach looks largely right. Remote learning has proved to be a dismal substitute for in-school education and a true catastrophe for many low-income children who lack the technology and/or family support to learn effectively at home. The long-term damage of their education may be life-altering. A McKinsey study estimates the closures could lead to 1 million additional high school dropouts. Meanwhile, roughly half the country did fully reopen schools this fall, without the devastating rise in infections some experts had predicted. In New York City, for instance, the rate among students and teachers in the city's reopened schools is only about 0.17%, compared with about 3% in the general population. A UNICEF report released last week states categorically that schools are not a main driver of community transmission. Nevertheless, says Nervi Shah in Politico.com, some states and cities, including New York, are now preparing to close schools again, while allowing bars, restaurants, and gyms that do spread the virus to stay open. If there must be more lockdowns, Let's this time put our children first and close the bars to open the schools. We're all desperate to return to normalcy, said Rachel Cohen in Prospect.org. But the science on reopening schools still isn't clear. Although children generally suffer milder symptoms from COVID-19, a small number do get very sick, especially preteens and teenagers. And children now make up 10% of all COVID-19 cases in the U.S., up from 2% in April. Indeed, recent studies from Israel and the U.K. suggest that children are actually more likely than adults to become infected, even as they're less likely to show symptoms. Whether they then infect their parents and other adults remains one of the fuzziest and most pressing questions. UNICEF recommends reopening schools, but only with basic safety measures in place. Those measures, mask mandates, air filters, on-site testing, and ample space between classroom desks, are far more common in affluent school districts, making reopening a dangerous gamble for the same low-income communities disadvantaged by remote learning. It's a question of priority, said Spencer Bocott-Lindell in the New York Times. Closing schools not only damages children educationally and emotionally, but also creates enormous stress for working parents. And the burden of unexpected family needs tends to fall on women, forcing many to give up their jobs. The politics of this issue are complex, said Benjamin Linus in Vox.com. The wrong-headed strategy of shutting schools to prevent coronavirus spread was largely favored in Democratic-leaning blue states. Republican red states were more aggressive about reopening schools, but did so recklessly, often in the midst of raging outbreaks, and had to close again quickly as students and teachers got infected. In many communities, this debate is becoming moot, said Aaron Richards and Eleanor Aspergen in USAtoday.com. In states where the pandemic is spiraling out of control, there are now too many teachers and staff infected or in quarantine to keep the schools open. Because our leaders failed to agree on a sensible national strategy to contain the virus in the spring and summer, the dominoes are beginning to fall at American schools. And we'll roll right into our good week, bad week segment. Seems it was a good week for discrimination. After Manhattan's upscale city winery announced it will require diners to take and pay for a $50 rapid coronavirus test before being allowed inside. Given the change of seasons, finding the next level of safety and comfort level for people to dine indoors is critical for us today, said CEO Michael Dorff. It's a good week for quiet reflection, with a Washington Post analysis showing that President Trump spoke only 8,143 words in public in the 18 days following his defeat in the election. Trump's pre-election average for 2020 was 8,398 words per day. And it was a good week for bragging rights after Barack Obama's A Promised Land sold nearly 890,000 copies in its first 24 hours on sale, putting it on track to be the best-selling presidential memoir in modern history. Wife Michelle's Becoming sold 725,000 copies on its first day. But it was a bad week for loyalty after Russian President Vladimir Putin was one of the few world leaders who declined to recognize Joe Biden as the winner of the presidential election. A Biden presidency, Putin said, wouldn't damage U.S.-Russia relations because they're already ruined. It was a bad week for ethnic stereotypes, with the filing of federal charges in Philadelphia against 15 alleged organized crime bosses, including Joseph Joey Electric Servideo, Louis Sheep Beretta, and Anthony Tony Meatballs Cifoli. Finally, it was a bad week for racism. After anti-racism guru Robin DiAngelo was reportedly paid $12,750 for a speech at the University of Wisconsin, 70% more than the $7,500 paid to her fellow keynoter, author Austin Channing Brown, a black woman. And a short news piece before we move on. Child migrants have a right to hearings. A federal judge has ordered the Trump administration to stop turning away child migrants who cross America's borders without first hearing their asylum petitions. Since March, the administration has immediately ejected almost 200,000 migrants, including about 13,000 minors traveling alone, without first considering their claims at a border facility. Administration officials cited a Centers for Disease Control order that temporarily bans the introduction of foreigners into America during the COVID pandemic. The CDC rule was pushed forward by White House advisor Stephen Miller. U.S. District Court Judge Emmett Sullivan said that while the CDC rule bars the introduction of foreigners carrying disease, it could not be used to justify mass expulsion of asylum seekers. On the briefing page, we have the vaccine breakthrough. Pfizer and Moderna may soon begin emergency distribution of coronavirus vaccines created with genetic technology. How do these vaccines work? Up to now, vaccines have introduced the immune system to a benign version of a virus or bacteria, priming it to recognize and fight the real pathogen if and when it strikes. Vaccines for measles, polio, the flu, and other infectious diseases use parts of or entire viruses that have been weakened or inactivated. The Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are based on a novel approach. They rely on a snippet of genetic material called messenger RNA, or mRNA, that is encased in a tiny protective bubble of fat. Messenger RNA, sometimes called the software of life, is usually made by DNA to carry instructions to other parts of the cell to make proteins. The vaccine makers constructed this specific form of RNA using the genetic sequence for the coronavirus, which was decoded back in January. That's how they were able to create a viable vaccine with a speed that shattered the previous record of about 4 years. Moderna went from obtaining the genetic sequence to inoculating the first test subject in just 63 days. What does messenger RNA do? When the coronavirus attacks, it hijacks the machinery of our body cells and instructs them to crank out more virus, generating a cascading assault. The vaccines take advantage of this process by injecting mRNA into muscle cells in the upper arm, which are instructed to manufacture just a piece of the coronavirus, the outside spike proteins, which the virus uses to latch onto cells. On their own, the spike proteins are harmless, but they trigger the immune system and train it to quickly react to and beat back the actual coronavirus. It's 21st century science, said William Schaffner, professor of preventative medicine at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. How well did these vaccines work? Phenomenally well so far. The benchmark for FDA approval is an efficacy rate of 50%, roughly the average of what flu vaccines achieve. Early results for the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine show about 95% efficacy, including for those over 65, a game-changing result. It makes it now clear that vaccines will be our way out of this pandemic, said Kanta Subbarao, an infectious disease expert at the University of Melbourne. The numbers were revealed in an interim analysis of late-stage studies that are still underway. In the studies, Moderna and Pfizer both injected tens of thousands of volunteers with either the vaccine or a placebo, then waited to see who got COVID through their real-world activities. In Pfizer's study, out of 170 who fell ill, Only 8 had received the vaccine. Moderna's numbers were similar. Moderna said vaccinated patients who did get COVID had mild cases, and both vaccines produced neutralizing antibodies and T cells, the 1-2 punch of the immune system. Based on those results, the FDA is expected to give the two vaccines emergency use authorization. Are there any drawbacks? The downside of messenger RNA is its fragility, which leads to significant practical hurdles. To keep from degrading, Pfizer's vaccine must be stored at minus 94 degrees Fahrenheit, roughly the winter temperature of the South Pole. That's a tremendous logistical issue, said Gregory Poland, a vaccine researcher at the Mayo Clinic. Pfizer has devised suitcase-sized shipping boxes that can keep vials sufficiently cold for up to 10 days using dry ice. But the temperature requirement is likely to limit the vaccine's distribution to urban hubs. Moderna's vaccine, however, can be stored in normal medical refrigerators. Both vaccines require 2 inoculations several weeks apart. Persuading hundreds of millions of Americans to return at the right interval adds another complication to an already daunting undertaking. What about safety? So far, the only side effects that have been reported by some recipients are fatigue, fever, joint pain, headaches, and soreness in the injection site lasting a day or two. Close monitoring of the study subjects will continue, but adverse vaccine effects typically surface early. Still, when tens of millions of people get the vaccines, you can never rule out that there won't be someone out there who might respond in an abnormal way, said Robin Shattuck, an immunology expert at Imperial College London. When can I get one? Both companies have manufactured tens of millions of doses and are ready to hit the ground running when approval is granted. Still, mass inoculation will take at least 4 to 6 months. It's the largest, most complex vaccination program ever attempted, said Kelly Moore of the Immunization Action Coalition. Healthcare workers will be the first in line and are likely to exhaust the 45 million doses, enough for 22.5 million people, that will be available in December and perhaps January. After that, priority is likely to be given to the elderly, essential workers such as police officers and firefighters, and those with underlying medical conditions. For the general population, experts say, we're looking at spring or early summer. The enormous promise of mRNA. The excitement over mRNA vaccines' early success extends well beyond what it means for the coronavirus pandemic. The trial data offer the first solid evidence for a technology whose potential has excited researchers for years and hold out great promise for the fight against other diseases. Experts say genetic technology could improve vaccines for the flu and other infectious diseases. It has the potential to create a new category of medicines, opening the door to treatments for heart disease, cancer, and autoimmune diseases. Moderna is currently testing the viability of an mRNA-based cancer therapy that's customized for each patient based on the mutations found in their tumor cells. And BioNTech, Pfizer's German partner, is working on vaccines to treat breast, skin, and pancreatic cancer. With a platform now in place, the mRNA coronavirus vaccines also offer a model for creating vaccines for future pandemics at previously unimaginable speed, weeks or months instead of years. Historic isn't even the right word, says Larry Corey, a virologist at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle. It's just an amazing accomplishment of science. Read a few of the best columns of the week, starting with one from the U.S. Did Graham commit election crimes? Lindsey Graham should be criminally investigated for election interference, said Mark Joseph Stern. Last week, Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, a Republican, claimed that the South Carolina senator called him to suggest he toss all mail-in ballots from heavily Democratic counties with high rates of mismatched ballot signatures, including the valid legally cast votes. It sure looked like he was wanting to go down that road, Raffensperger said. Graham called the allegation ridiculous and said he was merely inquiring about how signature verification works. But if what Raffensperger said is true, Graham broke at least two state laws. The first prohibits attempts to interfere with an election official's performance of any act or duty. The second involves criminal solicitation to commit election fraud. A U.S. senator exerting pressure on the Secretary of State to destroy ballots and falsify voting records certainly qualifies and carries a sentence of up to 3 years in prison. As a sitting Republican senator, Graham is unlikely to face investigation from the state's GOP attorney general or even a Senate ethics inquiry. But imagine the reaction if, say, a black Democratic woman had been caught trying to get thousands of legal ballots thrown out. This is from France. Eager to believe it's all a hoax. A crowd-funded documentary that purports to expose a vast coronavirus conspiracy is sweeping France, said Colleen Renaud. Hold Up, directed by former TV news reporter Pierre Bernier, was streamed by more than 3 million people in just its first week and is being promoted by celebrities such as Juliette Binoche and Sophie Marceau. It starts out innocuously enough by questioning inconsistencies in the management of the pandemic. Why were we first told not to wear masks, then to wear them? Why did the medical journal Lancet run an article saying hydroxychloroquine would not help COVID-19 patients, but then retract it? Eventually, the two-hour, 43-minute film leads viewers into obscure theories of global conspiracy involving presidents, the World Health Organization, the media, and the pharmaceutical industry. The film includes quotes from respected experts, but their speeches are often short and poorly contextualized. Philippe Douste-Blazy, a former French health minister, has asked for his quotes to be cut from the film because he does not support the wild theory that the virus was planned years in advance to profit Microsoft founder Bill Gates. The government and most health authorities have condemned Hold Up as baseless propaganda. But of course, to true believers, that's just further proof of their complicity. And this is from Canada. Not your grandpa's waterfall. You might think of Niagara Falls as a natural wonder, said Daniel McFarlane, but it hasn't been natural for a long time. In the 1950s, Canada and the U.S. were keen to harness the power of Niagara River on their mutual border for hydroelectric plants. They hatched a plan to divert the majority of the water through tunnels that begins upstream of the falls and feed plants downstream. Of course, the falls were a huge tourist draw, and massively cutting the 2,000 cubic feet of water that flowed over it every second would not be aesthetically pleasing. So the two nations agreed to a suite of engineering interventions, including shrinking the crest line of the Horseshoe Falls, the largest of Niagara's three falls, so that the reduced water flow would look just as impressive. The engineers also stapled together parts of Horseshoe Falls with steel cables to combat erosion. The changes stabilized the waterfall, which, to the consternation of local tourism businesses, had been moving upstream by 8 feet each year. These days, the tunnels divert half of the river's average flow during tourist hours and three-quarters the rest of the time. When visitors gaze at the waterfall, they don't see a natural phenomenon. They are, arguably, looking at the spillway of the hydroelectric complexes. time for The Last Word, our in-depth article. It's an interesting picture there. And the title is A Corner Store in Minneapolis. When a black 18-year-old clerk at Cup Foods got into an argument with a man named George Floyd, said Ayman Ismail in Slate.com, he called the police. The events that followed made the store a national flashpoint. Shortly after 8 p.m. on Memorial Day, May 25th, Mahmoud Mike Abunyale got a panic call from a teenage employee at the store he owns with his three brothers. Mike, they're killing me, she said. My heart dropped, like it fell to the ground, Mahmoud told me. He had no clue what she was talking about. At first, he assumed a customer was accosting a worker. Frantically, his employee explained what was happening. A police officer had pinned a customer to the ground outside the store, and that man was saying he couldn't breathe. Mahmoud manages the day shift at Cup Foods at the corner of 38th Street and Chicago Avenue in South Minneapolis. But that night, young employees were working the store alone. There'd been a brief confrontation with a man accused of passing a fake bill. Then an 18-year-old clerk dialed 911. The man was named George Floyd, and minutes later, a cop was kneeling on his neck. By the afternoon of after Floyd's killing, Cup Foods' voicemail box was full. As the day wore on, a devastated and furious group began to gather at the intersection. They chanted, prayed, and consoled one another. Outside the shop, their numbers swelled into the thousands. In the months that followed, the intersection would become a fortress of grief and protest, with sculptures and murals and constant visitors. Armed groups would patrol the area, and police would stay on other side of the barricades. The store would be vandalized repeatedly with blank Cup Foods spray painted on the exterior. Even longtime customers would question whether it ever deserved to reopen. The Abunyale brothers would fret over lowball offers to buy them out after Friday prayers at the mosque in the store's basement and struggle to imagine a future for the family business. But in those first days, they were only sure of one thing. Between the phone calls, threats, the protesters outside, Mahmoud said, he and his brothers decided they had to temporarily shut down. He believed that most of the threats Cup Foods was getting were a form of grief, expressions of outrage from people who felt powerless after watching another black man get killed by police. But he still didn't know what might happen. When the brothers closed the doors, they had no idea if they'd ever reopen at all. More than 30 years ago, Samir Abunyale had a choice to make. Born in Palestine, he was the oldest son of a family that arrived in the United States when he was a child. The family moved to North Minneapolis to open a small convenience store. When Samir graduated high school in 1989, he could either go to college or start his own shop like his father, Hamadeh, had and helped stabilize the finances for his parents and their 10 kids. He found an opportunity to lease a promising space on the other side of town, in South Minneapolis. The property had once been a drugstore and sat at the intersection of four neighborhoods. Samir went for it. He called his tiny corner store Chicago Unbeatable Prices, later shortened to just Cup. Over time, it expanded to include a deli, a cell phone repair shop, a notary public, and MoneyGram services. 6 years ago, Samir passed off responsibility for managing the store to three of his siblings, Mahmoud, Nabil, and Ahmad, though he's still a familiar figure there, known to most people as Sam. Samir is now 49 years old, and his hair is white and thick. He assertively leans forward when talking, but his voice is soft. He is eager to see business return to normal, but, he told me, as a native of as a native Palestinian, he understands the frustration coming from the protesters outside. God made this happen for a reason, he said in Arabic. It started a real reckoning that was needed. The way these cops treat black people here can never be justified. The four Abu Mayala brothers now co-own the shop together. There are reminders of their parents everywhere. A portrait of Hamada, who died in 2012, hangs on the wall behind the register. A recorded recitation of the Quran plays on repeat off one of the computers, just as it did when their parents were alive. The mosque in the basement, used by Muslims who work at local stores, auto shops, and restaurants, is dedicated to their mother's memory. It's called Masjid Nimat ul Islam. Her name was Nimat. Our mama, God rest her soul, when she was alive, she made me promise, Mahmoud said, don't ever sell this business. During the first week after Floyd's killing, someone threw a rock through Cup Foods' window. When I first visited in late July, the brothers still hadn't fixed it. A large wooden board covered part of the storefront. As I toured the shop, a neighbor was helping with cleanup, sweeping broken glass from the floor. Mourners brought flowers and balloons to place where George Floyd died near Cup Foods' doorstep. Organizers brought markers and cardstock for protesters to make their own signs. In the week after the killing, many left their signs on the ground or taped to walls, blending in with spray-painted graffiti that read, I can't breathe, and Black Lives Matter. While other areas of Minneapolis saw looting, locals and protesters wanted to preserve the area as a place of protest, especially the space immediately in front of Cup Foods. They established a perimeter around the intersection with barricades and declared it beyond the jurisdiction of police. On June 15th, Mahmoud and his brothers tried to open the store back up. That didn't last long. Many protesters who were holding the area down, including residents and activists from Chicago, viewed the reopening as an insult to Floyd's memory and their cause. People who were organizing around the store told the owners it wasn't safe to open. According to Mahmoud, they told the brothers, guys, there's too much animosity, there's too much pressure, it's not safe. And they promptly closed back down. Every time I ask the Abu Mayalas if I could meet the clerk who called 911, they said it wasn't going to happen. He's remained hidden from public view, his identity shielded by the rest of Cup Foods staff. But on one of my trips to Minneapolis, someone close to the store put us in touch. When we finally talked, he told me I was the first reporter he'd spoken to. Malik, who agreed to speak if I used a pseudonym, had arrived from West Africa last year to join relatives who were living in Minneapolis. Malik is a U.S. citizen, but had lived abroad since he was a baby. English is his second language, and even as a tall black teenager himself, he told me that he wasn't especially aware of the dynamic between black Americans and the police. When he dialed 911, he said he had no idea what could happen. The transcript of the call shows someone not quite used to calling the police. Operator. Is he white, black, native, Hispanic, Asian? Caller. Something like that. Operator. Which one? White, black, native, Hispanic, Asian? No, he's a black guy. All right. How is your day going? Not too bad. Had a long day, huh? The first week that he died, I was disturbed a lot. I couldn't sleep, Malik told me when we met in the city. I've been thinking about it every day, every night. Sleeping, dreaming, sitting, doing nothing. Malik said he had barely interacted with Floyd the night he was killed. He just came in, said what's up to me before everything happened. He came to all the employees, was saying hi to everybody, he said. Cup Foods is usually like that. After Floyd paid and left, a clerk passed the bill he used through a machine that identified it as fake. Another teenage employee confronted Floyd outside the store. According to Malik, Floyd refused to return the items he had purchased and cursed them out, basically trying to be an extra on them, as Malik put it. As the other teenager returned to the store, Malik said the employee told him to call 911. So Malik did. Floyd is sitting on his car because he's awfully drunk. He's not in control of himself, Malik told the 911 operator. When Mahmoud got the desperate call from the employee, the police were there, and Floyd was pinned down outside. Mahmoud said he told the employee to call the police again. Specifically, he said, call the police on the police and make sure you record it. Mahmoud said he had been through this before. He said a police officer used to harass Cup Foods customers around the store, so he called the cop on the cop. It worked, he said, and the harassment stopped. It wouldn't work this time. A 911 dispatcher who was watching a live feed of the interaction had also reported the officer's actions to no avail. Derek Chauvin, the officer later charged in the killing, knelt on Floyd's neck for 8 minutes while onlookers pleaded with him to stop. Surveillance video I later reviewed showed one of Nabil's sons, who was at the store, trying to intervene and the police shoving him away. An hour later, Floyd was pronounced dead. I was in shock, Mahmoud said. The brothers can't help but feel that if only one of them had been there that night, things might have turned out differently. We would have just taken the fake money and banned him like we do all the time, Nabil said. That's what we do. Take the fake money and tell them you can't come back in here for 2 years. But the teens manning the store thought they were doing the right thing. They got fake money. They called the cops, Nabil said. It was escalated by a piece of blank cop. He had no remorse for human life. None. The corner where Cup Foods sits has now been dubbed George Floyd Square. The space outside the shop where Floyd was killed has become a sprawling memorial. On the ground where he was pinned by Chauvin, someone painted a silhouette with angel's wings. It's now a landmark, with people coming from around the world, some fresh off the plane with suitcases in tow, to see for themselves. Welcome to George Floyd Square, volunteers say with a smile, offering up a spritz of hand sanitizer and a mask. After more than 2 months, mostly dark, Cup Foods finally reopened on August 3rd to a very different neighborhood. Protesters tried to force it to close again, barricading the entrance with large trash receptacles. But this time, the Abu Mayales decided to forge ahead. The business is now bringing in around 70% of the revenue it did before Floyd's killing. The streets around the store are still closed off to vehicular traffic, so the people who shop there now only buy what they can easily carry on foot, usually chips, cigarettes, or water. Back at the store recently, one of the customers, Sal, a tall black man with a voice so quiet it's close to a whisper, was teasing Mahmoud's son, joking that he's gotten taller but not any stronger. He told me he's been coming in since he was a kid. I grew up around here, he said. It's where we can get together, conversate, run into people. I asked him what he made of the protesters outside who think the store ought to be replaced with a community center. It already is a community center, he said. In the basement mosque that August weekend, the imam was late, so a worshiper stepped in to give the sermon instead. It was focused on George Floyd. He was a black man, but you don't have to be black to feel like that was you, he told the group gathered beneath Cup Foods. He was a human being first, and no human ever should die the way they killed him. No one. Not black, not white, not Muslim, not Christian, not Jewish, nobody. It's terrorism, the worshiper said, what they did to him and to all of us. This was adapted from a story originally published in Slate.com. Here's a Health and Science article. Deep sleep versus Alzheimer's. A growing body of evidence suggests that deep sleep may help reduce risk for Alzheimer's. Two of the hallmarks of the neurodegenerative disease are high levels of the proteins beta amyloid and tau. Previous research has found a link between a lack of deep sleep, when the body temperature drops and the brain produces slow rhythmic electrical waves, and increased levels of tau. To see if the same is true for beta amyloid, researchers measured the slow electrical waves in 32 people in their 70s. They then monitored participants' beta amyloid levels with brain scans for up to 6 years. Sure enough, those who got less deep sleep had more beta amyloid. There is something about this deep sleep that is helping protect you, co-author Matthew Walker from the University of California, Berkeley, tells NPR.org. The most likely explanation is that during deep sleep, the brain activates a mechanism that flushes through the brain, washing away beta amyloid and tau. Significantly, each wave of fluid was preceded by a slow electrical wave. Scientists hope that if they can artificially induce the electrical waves that signify deep sleep, that might trigger the dishwasher-like effect. And here's an innovation of the week on the technology page. A startup is developing a wearable with LiDAR to help blind people navigate their surroundings, said Rob Pegaroro in Fast Company. LiDAR uses pulses of light to detect nearby objects more accurately than radar or sonar and has gained in popularity as a tool for self-driving cars and cameras of high-end smartphones, like the iPhone 12 Pro Max. Now, Strap Technologies has put LiDAR in a chest-worn device for calculating the proximity of hazards such as walls, steps, nearby people, and bumps in a sidewalk. The information is conveyed to the wearer via a vibration pattern. Strap CEO says that a visually impaired person is actually more difficult to guide than a self-driving car. While cars stay on carefully mapped roads, you can't expect people to take any one path. And we'll go right on over to the Talking Points page to finish out the hour. We'll start with an article titled, Student Loan Debt, the $10,000 Proposal. Student loan forgiveness is a mediocre idea whose time has come, said Jordan Weissman in Slate.com. President-elect Joe Biden will likely inherit a divided Congress that will make big, bold, constituency-pleasing, and legacy-making moves all but impossible. But a growing chorus of Democrats, led by Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senator Elizabeth Warren, believe that he can unilaterally enact debt forgiveness via executive action. Schumer is pushing for forgiveness of up to $50,000 per borrower, but last week Biden indicated his preference for the House Democrats' proposal to forgive $10,000, only for economically distressed debtors. Biden said borrowers are having to make choices between paying their student loan and paying the rent, adding that such relief should come immediately. Forgiving student loans is a terrible idea, said Kyle Smith in NationalReview.com. By wiping the slate clean for some, while others scrimped or worked two jobs for years to make loan or tuition payments, would risk making the latter group feel like chumps for playing by the rules. A society of chumps is an angry society with little respect for elites and institutions. Wiping away debt freely took on not only would create a moral hazard, said WashingtonExaminer.com in an editorial, it would also provide a tremendous wealth transfer to college graduates. The Brookings Institution said that the highest earning 40% of households, or those earning above $74,000, owe almost 60% of the nation's $1.7 trillion in student loan debt and make almost 75% of the payments. Biden would be foolish to start out with a massive bailout for the elites. Biden has it right, said Adam Looney in the Washington Post. By targeting loan forgiveness at the most strapped borrowers and capping the amount at $10,000 per person, he will ensure the money gets into the hands of the 15 million borrowers with smaller balances. They're actually the folks who struggle most and account for roughly 60% of defaults. In the end, forgiving student loans doesn't address the fundamental problem, the impossibly expensive cost of a college education, said Annie Lowry in TheAtlantic.com. The average tuition and expenses of a single year at a private college have risen to $37,000. Still, Biden will soon have the authority to relieve many struggling Americans of debt that's only grown more crippling during the pandemic. Why not magic at least some of it away? Trump, the prosecution dilemma. When he takes office in January, Joe Biden will face a historic dilemma, said Jonathan Mahler in the New York Times Magazine. How to deal with Donald Trump's flagrant and relentless subversion of the rule of law. Presidents have traditionally resisted taking legal action against previous administrations. Consider George H.W. Bush pardoning Reagan, officials involved in the Iran-Contra, or Barack Obama opting not to prosecute members of George W. Bush's administration who authorized torture. The stakes of an indictment of Trump would be high, and because a president's authority under the Constitution is so broad, the odds of a conviction low. But from campaign finance violations to blatant self-enrichment to witness tampering to obstruction of justice, no president has ever left office with so much potential criminal liability. Without a legal reckoning for his unprecedented defiance, how does our nation maintain the rule of law? Trump must face consequences, said Renee Graham in the Boston Globe. Biden has reportedly told aides he fears investigating Trump would further deny a nation he's pledged to unite. But to ignore 4 years of scandals and corruption of this staggering scope would set a dangerous precedent. To give Trump a pass would be to sanction further corruption, said Jeet here in The Nation. His sordid administration is the culmination of Washington's culture of elite impunity, exemplified by Gerald Ford's post-Watergate pardoning of Richard Nixon, as well as the Iran-Contra pardons. The only way to end this corrupt cycle is if the Biden administration breaks with history and holds Trump accountable. Biden has higher priorities, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com. His administration could drag Trump into court for a spectacle that would make O.J. Simpson's trial look quiet, obscure, and dignified, or he can focus on getting his agenda through Congress. But he can't have both. Prosecution would make Trump a martyr, inflame the partisan divide, and lead to civil unrest, said Michael Conway in NBCNews.com. So Biden should do the unthinkable and grant Trump a pardon. Because it would apply only to federal crimes, Trump would still have to answer for possible tax and financial crimes now under investigation in New York. Accepting a pardon, not incidentally, means admitting guilt. Pardoning him may be the only way that Trump even implicitly concedes he did anything wrong. Some shorter notes here. The 24 counties in Kansas that complied with a mask mandate issued by the governor in July amid a major surge in coronavirus cases saw a 6% net decrease in new infections by mid-August, according to a new CDC report, while 81 counties that opted out saw a 100% increase. The research adds to the evidence supporting the importance of wearing masks. Housing Secretary Ben Carson says he became desperately ill with COVID-19 after attending maskless events at the White House, but is recovering after getting the same experimental monoclonal antibody therapy President Trump received. Carson said he believes that therapy, not available to most COVID patients, saved my life. The FBI reported 7,314 hate crimes in 2019, the highest number since 2008. The actual number is probably much higher, given that only 2,200 police jurisdictions out of 15,000 nationwide report data to the FBI. Anti-Semitic hate crimes numbered 953, a 14% increase over the previous year. More than 900 staff members at the Mayo Clinic's locations in Minnesota and Wisconsin have been diagnosed with COVID-19 in the past 2 weeks, and another 600 are sidelined by quarantines. More than 90% of the workers infected, the clinic said, picked up the virus in the surrounding communities, not while caring for patients. On the poll watch, 56% of American voters are now feeling hopeful about the state of the nation, up from 47% in June, but only 39% of Trump voters feel hopeful, down from 53% in June. And we'll finish out with a quote from statistician Klaus Moser, who tells us, education costs money, but then so does ignorance. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.